Welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the podcast for BP Southside Baseball Prospectus' local site covering the Chicago White Sox. You can find this podcast on iTunes by searching for the Catbird Speaks. I'm Colin Whitchurch, joined as always by Nick Schaefer. What's up, Nick?
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
And also joining us today is our old friend, the hardest working man on White Sox Twitter, James Fegan. Hey, James.
White Sox Twitter. What an esteemed working group.
So
thanks for having me.
Yeah. Welcome back to the show, to our maybe our last episode of the regular season. Maybe we'll try to squeeze one in next week.
I thought you were going to say it's just canceled.
Our last show ever. So it is Thursday afternoon. The White Sox have the second worst record in all of baseball at the time of this recording. But the young guys are playing well. Moncada and Giolito, et cetera. So is this the best 91 loss team in baseball history?
Boy, my cat has opinions on this.
What?
It's probably, I mean, I just wondered. I was worried that you guys are overhearing her meowing at me.
When you said it and then pointed it out, I heard like a very, it sounded like she was meowing into like a digital hostage note sort of thing. you know, the distortion, the call distorter thing. It sounded like that. So, hey, Simba.
I have no idea if it's the best 91 loss team in history. It's possible. I guess it's fairly unique to have a team be as bad as they were post All-Star break and have basically a number one, the top of a number one, like, system in baseball just dumped into it, like, for the last, like, month and a half. I mean,
I can't believe you seriously tried to answer that question.
Yes, there have been other, like, top farm systems, but I think it's rare that you can drop prospects of the quality of Moncada, Lucas Giolito, Ronaldo Lopez, Nicky Baseball,
Hell yeah.
All within kind of a six-week span.
So Giolito and Moncada are the real highlights here. What is it? Giolito's thrown, I think, five of his last six starts have been qualities. You know, Moncada has been tearing the absolute cover off the ball. It is kind of weird, like, the way I phrased that question was obviously a joke, but, like, we're sitting here and there are 31 games under 500, and every day it's like, well, hey, the White Sox did something interesting today because, well, maybe they lost again, but the kids are playing well, right?
I guess I would say, like, Giolito's six of six of not looking shelled and hopeless.
Yeah.
But whatever statistical measure that is.
I know DRA hasn't loved what Giolito's been doing.
There is no metric that does not hate him.
ERA loves him.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, like, do you see anything in his outings that should inspire one to take heart and sort of turn a blind eye to those peripherals?
His fastball works for all the concern about lost velocity and the fact that he basically averages 92. He doesn't really get crushed on that at all. He uses it for a swing and miss. He knows how to elevate it now, which apparently was something he only kind of thought of to do within the last year. Sounds like since he's been traded that, you know, elevating his fastball for swing and miss is something that is part of his game now. So that's a legit reason to hope it'll be more useful than all the low spin panic that accompanied his Nationals debut, because all he was doing was just trying to pound the lower part of the zone with it and without having it having extra life of, you know, that we look for spin rate that didn't seem like a plan that was going to work. So it seems like on nights where his secondaries are not commanding or locating well, which early samples suggest will not be an entirely infrequent thing, his fastball is good enough to carry him through and be a primary pitch like it should be, as opposed to like someone like James Shields, who now throws under 40% heaters because of how much life and stuff it's lost over the years. that explain what I think is positive?
Yeah, totally. Because it's hard to just, you know, when you're talking about, I'm getting questions like I had just did a BP chat over on the main site, and people asked me what I thought of Giolito, and it's writing for a site like Baseball's at Prospectus. It's kind of hard to just ignore that DRA is sort of screaming like all kinds of red flags. But I guess with a 22-year-old, you can still tell yourself that process is more important than just the results, certainly at this stage. And I've seems to be that his changeup is ahead of where people thought it might be. I don't know if you agree with that hypothesis, but that's also something we've seen a lot more emphasis of it, certainly in his time with the White Sox.
Yeah, it seems like his second best pitch or his best secondary is best off speed. All his reputation was based on his curveball, and you know, when it's working, it definitely seems overwhelming, and it's definitely far ahead from the slider he's been working on, in my opinion. But you know, if you talk to him, he would always be like, "Oh, I love my changeup. I feel really comfortable with my changeup. I think it's really good. It's in the same arm slot of my fastball, so I can command it really well." And you know, at the time I was like, yeah, okay, that's nice, Lucas. But he's had the result in the majors to really make that, you know, not seem crazy. And you know, it's weird that both him and Ronaldo, you don't really think of right-handed starters being fastball changeup primarily, but that's what they've been early on. It's been more consistently functioning with Lucas than with Ronaldo so far, but it looks real.
Have you gotten a chance to ask him about baking yet?
No, I mean, you know, you want to like start these conversations naturally, I guess. I don't know if baking is something to go like, "Hey, Lucas, do you have 5 minutes?" and then launch into baking questions with no preparation, or if I should like, you know, get a chance to chat him up a little bit and then like talk about like, because he referenced something about tweeting. The last time I was interviewing him, but I was interviewing him alongside like Bruce Levine, and I thought Bruce would probably get a little weirded out if I launched into like a discussion of baking tweets with Lucas Giolito, because I love Bruce to death, but that doesn't really seem like what would he even consider his comfort zone or where he's trying to steer the conversation at that time.
James, you're new media. You've got to, they got to just get with the times or get left behind. It's baking Twitter time. That's is what I'm trying to say.
He hasn't tweeted about baking like since he got traded. I wonder if it's like some,
because the Beats have shown no interest in it.
But like all his baking tweets are with like Spencer Kaiboom or Kaboom or however their name is said, like his old Nationals roommates. And now those guys are gone, and now he's in the majors, and like he probably like does something weird and adult, like live with his girlfriend by himself instead of with other grown men. I don't know.
I think it's a good off-season question, because it's like, hey, you know, what do you got planned for the off-season? You're going to start baking again? And there you go.
Soxfest. Soxfest is the target day for it. Ask him there.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's easier now that I've had, like, 3 or 4 or 5 interviews with him, as opposed to, like, the first thing the stranger is saying to you is about baking, where it's supposed to, like, hey, we've talked a while. We cracked the ice. There's nothing more to talk about. That's why I'm asking you weird baking questions, just to kind of change things up, as opposed to like, hey, what baking shows you watch? Like being accosted by some weird guy in a sweater at Soxfest.
Well, the thing is, though, he tweeted about it. It's not like you were rummaging around in the dumpster behind his apartment and found a bundt cake tin.
I mean, he tweeted about Charlottesville, too. I think it'd probably still be weird to walk up and ask him about it.
Well, one's a little bit more fun than the other.
So, Nazis. I mean, not your thing?
And it's broadcaster's opinion. So moving over to Lopez, who's kind of... Well, I mean, is it just fair to assume Giolito's just going to be in the rotation at the beginning of next year, and Lopez as well, and that's kind of where we're at?
Who would you put instead?
No idea. I've been assuming that. I wanted to check in with somebody who's in the clubhouse regularly.
I would agree. I would think you're... I mean, at this point, I would think it would not be insane to think you start the season with Rodon, Giolito, Lopez, Shields, Fulmer. The, I think, wild cards here would be, is Rodon healthy at the start of the season? Is this shoulder inflammation thing linger? Is it something that pops up in spring? Stuff like that. And the other one would be, does Fulmer end the season strong? Is he starting the year in the majors and the rotation because he's just doing that well? Or is he starting AAA again and they sign someone like, you know, Jeremy Hellickson to eat innings and something like that? Or do, at this point, I really don't think they like cut Shields and like just eat the last year of his contract. That might be something that happens, I think, middle of next season if he doesn't improve, or, you know, he drops down and becomes Cy Young again.
Again.
Well, I mean, you'd have to think. Yeah, I mean, I don't think they just cut Shields, especially because he's, looks like he's muddling through at this point. He's not having.
He looks like a five.
Yeah, he's not doing that stuff where he's giving up like eight runs in the before he gets four outs, and you just can't use them at all. Like, he'll,
or like,
get
somehow surpassing his 2016 home run rate at portions of the season.
Right. But I guess that version of Shields is kind of could crop back up again at any moment. And so even beyond wanting to ensure, you know, guys like Rodon for injury and Giolito and Lopez just for inexperience and things like that, you'd have to imagine they'd be bringing in some insurance-y veteran-type arms. I mean, this year was Holland, and they obviously kept Miguel Gonzalez. But, you know, you'd have to think they'd want to keep something in between those guys and Chris Volstead and whatever else is in Charlotte right now.
Yeah, I mean, the scouts I spoke to said, like, oh, it's mandatory. They absolutely have to have a veteran who can make starts. I mean, you can't expect that you're going to get 200 innings out of Giolito and Lopez, and you don't know what Shields is going to be, and, you know, Carson Fulmer two starts ago, like, was doomed to be a reliever, and Rodon hasn't been healthy, so you absolutely have to get in somewhere. But at the same time, laying all those five guys out, you know, Rodon, Giolito, Lopez, Shields, Fulmer, and the fact that, you know, Michael Kopech is probably ready as soon as you decide that he's ready in, you know, June after whatever the Super 2 date is, and the fact that you are going to have a AAA rotation that's going to have Spencer Adams, Jordan Stevens, possibly Jordan Guerrero, and all those kind of, you know, swingman insurance types, along with Tyler Danish is still there, and Al Canson hopefully burning his way towards the majors at the same lightning pace he was on this year. It doesn't feel really exciting to clutter that with a, you know, some 90 ERA plus veteran, but I understand it might be a logistical thing that you have to do.
I mean, certainly to get you through that first 4 to 6 weeks, because you don't want to be in a position to, like, I don't know, throw Jordan Guerrero at it if you think he could use a couple more months, I would think. I mean, he's not the type of prospect you know, change your org plans around. But, you know, I'd prefer not to just burn him.
Yeah. And I don't know if you want to put David Holmberg in the rotation mix again next year. Oh, you could.
I do. I personally really do. I love David Holmberg.
He's weird. I mean, I don't know if, like, he had good numbers in the bullpen to start, but I don't know. He sits 88. His stuff didn't really seem to jump up in velocity or anything.
So
in the bullpen, but and then at the same time, he was staying stretched out, so I don't know.
So one of the guys you mentioned as being potentially a part of the rotation next year is someone that's had a couple of interesting starts to me in Carson Fulmer. You know, two straight good starts. The one against the Giants was really good. He's had a freaking terrible year at AAA. Is it just kind of small sample size nonsense, or have you seen something in him that's kind of been different than what we've seen from him for most of the year?
I thought, if anything, the Tigers start was more impressive for him in terms of just being in the zone with everything.
Sure.
Like, based on what Carson Fulmer did in AAA this year, and based on his general reputation of having huge stuff and, you know, a janky, herky-jerky delivery, it's probably the more surprising line to see him get through six innings with five Ks and one walk than, you know, nine Ks and three walks.
Sure.
But in general, like, he kind of said that he hadn't really been using the cutter in the minors, despite the fact that his cutter is 90 miles an hour with, like, slider-type break. He said he was trying to work on different stuff, but I'm betting that sometime after he got promoted and maybe sometime after his first start that, you know, someone employed by the Chicago White Sox organization, possibly for decades, might have brought up the whole cutter thing as something he should reemphasize again. Since Fulmer also said, like, you know, Cooper originally suggested the cutter back, I think, last year. So there is something to the idea of, you know, he wasn't using that in AAA, and that's an asset now. There's also something to the idea of AAA. He talked a lot about being a sinker ball pitcher and pounding his own and pitching to contact. And since he's been promoted, he's been doing a lot more of elevating his four-seamer above the zone like Giolito did for swing and misses really effectively. sorry, that everyone's going to hear me coughing. I know, you know, Don Cooper is very much involved in the larger view of how pitches develop, but it is weird to see how much both Giolito and Fulmer, since getting promoted and working directly with him, have all of a sudden become guys who throw high fastballs for swing and misses a lot more than they were working on in the minor leagues. And I don't know if that's just getting to see them up close and seeing that it's something to be effective for them. I don't know if they're really just focusing on the minors on certain things and not using their full complement that they would use in the majors, but they've both kind of been different guys up here for whatever reason.
Did you see anything in that first Fulmer start that was a complete disaster that would reflect that? Do you think that's consistent with what he was trying to do and in AAA, whereas the last two starts are the different approach?
It was hard to say what he was doing.
Right?
The first start, because, like,
it was really bad.
Missing all your spots by a foot with your, like, straight fastballs. Like, it's hard to really tell what your plan is.
He did get one swinging strike in that game.
Yeah, the greatest changeup of all time that he then, like, didn't use again. And then still rarely uses now. Like, all of a sudden, he threw, like, an 85-mile-an-hour change of, like, dropped like it was a 12-6 curve, and like Kenny Vargas swung so hard he almost fell down, and then he didn't throw a changeup again and he walked him. Like, it was the weirdest, like, wow, I can really see why they think he's talented and why they think he has great stuff, but man, is he a mess, like, type of moment.
I mean, do you see a starter's arsenal where he, like, basically throws three fastballs and a change? Like, is that a thing? I mean, he holds his velocity seemingly pretty well.
Yeah, he's very consistently 94, 95 when he needs it. I guess it's if you consider the cutter one of his fastballs. It really, like it has
right.
cutter.
That's what I'm saying.
It kind of moves like a slider. So it's weird to classify it. Like, he definitely kind of uses it in the typical Danks way of trying to jam opposite-handed hitters with it. But when he's just facing righties, it's effectively a nightmare 90-mile-an-hour slider.
Okay, because, like, that's, you know, the traditional thing you look for a starter is, like, does he have, you know, a traditional breaking ball to get same-handed hitters out, and then a changeup or even a, you know, a cutter, like a curve or something to, like, get opposite-hand hitters out. And he might, you know, unless if the cutter does move that much, you can just say, all right, we're calling it a cutter, but, like, it's a slider.
I mean,
otherwise he's got two pitches in the same and like the anti-lefty category, and he might be like a weird reverse platoon guy.
I mean, I think he's going to be a very fastball heavy guy, just because his fastball is so much natural life on it, and his command is so fringy that, like, kind of relying on throwing other stuff for a strike is always, it's not really something he can rely on. So he kind of needs it to get ahead of the count. Pretty much ever. He doesn't have a lot of capability to pitch people backwards. So yeah, that's kind of why I see him as.
So, like, just changing the subject here, sort of, to Ronaldo Lopez. Obviously, this hasn't been what I expected to happen. I hadn't really been expecting him to go deep into games efficiently, not walk anybody, but also never strike anyone out. Right? I mean, isn't that sort of the opposite of what you would have guessed for Ronaldo Lopez?
Yeah, so, I mean, even, like, his run, his big, like, hot, like, stretch that got him promoted, he was having some games where he, you know, would strike out 9 or 10, but only go 5 innings because he just spent so many pitches.
Right, yeah, he was posting, you know, lots of, I'd have to pull it up, but my recollection was that, yeah, like, the strikeouts were coming in bunches, and, you know, you pointed out, I recall, you know, he had his 7 strikeout outing against Tampa, and then the next outing he only struck out 2, but he still had 9 swinging strikes, and it was still a good outing. And then the next outing, he goes 6 innings, allows 3 runs, 0 walks, 1 strikeout, 3 swinging strikes.
Is that the Kansas City one?
Yeah, and then again against
Detroit. He had no secondaries that day. That was just what basically 6 innings of Ronaldo Lopez pumping heat looks like.
Isn't it weird that he's only getting, you know, for his heat, though, shouldn't he be getting more than 1 strikeout every 6-7 innings?
Yeah, I mean, you think the stuff definitely is really loud, and you would assume that's going to happen more, but it's just not really consistent.
Like, should we just look at the glass half full and say he's going deep into games, he's pitching efficiently, he's not walking people, and just call that a win? Because, like, the stuff is there.
I mean, that would definitely be tempting to do that. I mean, he's 23. There's definitely room to develop, but at the same time, you definitely see the way that he kind of has these bursts of the stuff being like wipeout and having everything working and having bursts of like poor command that you see where the he's a reliever talk comes from. I wouldn't doom him for that, especially at this point in the rebuild where you can just start him and see how he grows. But there's definitely the inconsistency with this stuff not being consistent through 6 innings against swing and misses, and that you understand why some people thought like this would work better in bursts.
Right. Okay. All right. I just want to make sure I wasn't like crazy with how that this is a really odd month for him.
Yeah. Like he hasn't really consistently had the curveball. Since calling up, like it's been there in kind of fits and starts, but it really, he really hasn't been a consistent 3-pitch guy. It's pretty weird for a right-hander to be as fastball changeup as he's been. So, yeah, he hasn't looked like the complete finished package. Now, you know, I didn't watch him a lot last year. I don't know if this is, most people said that he's more consistent with his delivery than last year, and you know, maybe he'll take another step forward the year after this, but right now, it's kind of incomplete.
I mean, if he could keep going at this sort of rate, you know, where he's giving you a league average, a little below, I guess he's a 90 ERA plus right now, but that's with the injury start mixed in. I guess it's like, all right, I mean, you could muddle through with this version of him as like a back-end starter, but that's certainly not what you'd hope for someone with his potential. Colin, did you have anything else for James on these sort of arrived pitching prospects?
Not on the pitching prospects. I was about ready to ask him if there's anything notable to say. I feel like talking about Yoan Moncada has almost gotten boring at this point, because it's like when he wasn't hitting, when the ball wasn't falling, it was like, well, he's still taking walks, his batter's eye is there, we're really impressed with it, and now kind of the BABIP looks, you know, coming around. He's, you know, since the start of September, he's raised his batting average from 189 to 241. Is there anything interesting? Is there anything noteworthy about that, or is it just kind of, hey, good prospect turns out to be good?
I mean, he's putting the ball in play more. I don't know. He was always someone who was supposed to have the bat speed that, you know, the balls he put in play, would be harder contact than most, and that's why he'd be able to live up higher. And the fact that he has plus speed, though, I can't really say that I have a lot of like he has 3 infield hits. I can't say he's like, you know, he's not Luis Castillo like slapping the ball on the ground and spraying it out all the time. But
it's not Avisel Garcia either.
Right. It's not like he's just hitting bouncers all the time and just running it out. But his speed should in general give him more both extra bases and, you know, a little bit of tinge of BABIP along with it to, you know, be a guy who sits 340, 350, maybe not 350 with his BABIP consistently. I think the interesting thing about him is that he basically has the same weighted runs created as Rafael Devers now, which
yeah, using suck it, after Red a Sox. Solid
month of the White Sox traded for the wrong guy because Dave Dombrowski totally put Rafael Devers on the table and said, choose between him and Yan Moncada, and Rincon, like, you know, started pouring sweat like the pilot at the end of the airplane and then picked the wrong guy. That's totally what happened in how the trade
with. Yeah, and Dombrowski, you know, chortled as he twirled his mustache and strutted away with a diamond encrusted cane and said, better luck next time or something like that.
I love also how when people talk about, like, when they brought up, like, they picked the wrong prospect guy, that you're completely ignoring the fact that they also got Michael Kopech, who is, like, a legit, like, top 5 and 10 prospect in baseball now, also in addition to the recently promoted Moncada.
Right, and, you know, these are – it's like this weird incongruous – it's like a cognitive disconnect where these people who are saying, this is what Dombrowski does, he hustles people with prospects, all massacred him for the Pomeranz trade.
Yeah.
And now, like, Anderson Espinosa, as 18-year-old pitchers do, is injured, and Drew Pomeranz just gave, like, you know, had, like, an excellent season for a playoff team.
I like the idea that, like, Dombrowski's a supervillain, and it was like that weird video game that James Bond plays, and he had Han strapped in it, and he had to, like, pick Moncada or Devers, and he accidentally pressed the wrong button, and then, like, all these red lights started flashing, and it locked him out of the game as he's, like, trying to, like, fix his choice. And
see, I think it was more like the Genghis Khan music video where they just got up and started dancing with each other. No, am I the only one who gets that reference? Cool.
I'm sorry.
Genghis Khan music video?
Yeah, from Mike Snow. Come on, I know music.
Yeah, the problem is I don't.
Anyway...
So, Victor Diaz walked 12 guys in 12 innings this year in between disabled stints, so it's a bad trade.
Yeah.
Right. And Luis Pizabe is not in the majors yet, so definitely lost
here. I don't know why he hasn't turned into Victor Robles yet.
His English has improved.
Is it Robles or Robles?
Gotta be Robles, right?
Right.
I always thought Robles was cooler.
Me too.
Really?
I don't know. It sounds like a currency.
I think I can guess which currency. Yeah. Okay. So Moncada is back on track to his destiny of being an MVP candidate. A prospect who was not as globally heralded, but has also had a huge resurgence of late. I guess he's no longer a prospect, but Tim Anderson on the other side of the middle infield. Should we just go right back to assuming that Moncada and Anderson will be the most exciting middle infield in the majors for the next, like, 6 years?
No. I don't know. Like, neither of them are, like, wizards, like, defensively. Right. They both have things they do well, but it's not like, I don't know, Lindor and Altuve out there or something. Like, Moncada has, like, he has a strong arm. He really loves that Robinson Cano throw, probably more than he should. But he's a little mechanical and stiff out there. He kind of, like, baffed a play off of, like, a ball off the mound from James Shields. I think that was last night. Pretty badly. It was just, and I think Wimpy was, like, critiquing his form, that he didn't get his knees down. And, you know, Tim Anderson has good athleticism and a good throwing arm and good range, but he's probably never going to be a great hands guy. He's not going to lead the majors in errors like every year. And that's probably going to calm down and be normal. But he's not going to be like an elite, you know, Ozzie Smith can bare hand 104 mile an hour liners out of the air or anything like that. That's going to be a shortcoming. So I think I mean, I think I think our biggest like hope for Tim Anderson is that he provides league average offense and average shortstop defense from premium position for a long period of time. Like, I think we all have an understanding of why that's really good and really valuable and why it's a cornerstone of your franchise to have that in place, but it's also probably not, you know, absolute maximum sexiness profile. Whereas Mankata is kind of like, you're fitting this raw power and, you know, probably significantly plus offense and, you know, good speed and good throwing arm into a package that you're kind of jamming into second base because it's so valuable there. And, you know, he plays it well enough to stick, but this is not electric to watch. So they'll probably won't be the most exciting double play combination in general, but they'll be really kind of valuable without necessarily being sexy.
My dad was actually asking me, like, why...
They're both handsome guys, so I guess they're sexy in that way.
Well, yeah, they're both super fast, athletic, and they're probably going to be... Mankata, very likely, and Anderson potentially could be very entertaining on offense, was part of the question, or at least as I intended. But my dad was even asking me in an email the other day, like, you know, Mankata... He was basically saying, like, Mankata to me looks like a dude who'd be really good in center field. Like, he could use his speed more... He's got the arm for it. Like, is that just not on the table? I mean, do you sense that his defense? I mean, his defense, second, what you're saying is like, it's got its rough edges. It's not to say he can't improve as time goes on, but is that a possibility still, or is it just he's at second? He's going to, you know, work through his lumps and it's going to be fine.
I think everything they've been trying to do this year has been to, there's a big emphasis on stability. They don't want to bring their starters up and down, and they don't want to move their position players all over the diamond, except for the ones that they do. And the ones that they do feel that way about, you can probably tell. And Yolmer Sanchez and Tyler Saladino and Eulery Garcia all entered the year really firmly knowing that they're going to be utility guys and move around. But for Anderson and for Mankata, they strongly emphasize the fact that they want to stick them there and let them know that they're going to be there every day. And Mankata, at least, has been very, I mean, Anderson really hasn't had to answer any questions about, are you going to move, even despite the errors, because it's been very clear that he's a shortstop for the future. But Mankata has talked about the stability that he's had being a huge plus for him, knowing that he's not going to get yanked out of the lineup for struggling for, like, 4 weeks, and knowing that he's going to be at second base and he should prepare there every day and devote all his practice in AAA, knowing that he's a second baseman, has been helpful for him. So I think they're committed.
Okay. I mean, I think
no, Nick, they're not going to do it.
But... Okay.
Question.
So I don't know, Nick, if you had anything else. I feel like we've talked about just about everything that's interesting about the Major League roster at this point.
Colin hates Nicky Delmonico, is what he's trying to say.
Okay. Well, there's plenty of things we could talk about, like Jose Abreu's is still awesome, and Avisail Garcia, and obviously the handsome Nicky Delmonico, but people aren't going to tune in for that. So we can start pestering James about his recently released top 30 prospects, in which he listed a few guys who are made up. And I guess we could start at the top. You talk a little bit about this in your write-up. I don't want to give away everything, considering it's behind a paywall, but what was your kind of determining factor in saying Jimenez is the number one prospect over Kopech?
I got yelled at because I had Kopech over Jimenez.
You did have him there initially, Kopech?
Yeah. And so, I got told to not BP it.
don't put up... Is it just he's a pitcher?
Pretty much, yeah.
And Eloy's a good enough bat where, like...
I mean, BP listed Alex Reyes number one before the season. Come on.
Yeah, that's what it...
Oh, wait, yeah. I see. That's the BPing.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah.
And because Kopech is closer, Kopech is pretty much major league ready. And I listed out my positional concerns with Jimenez, who I think is probably a below average runner now, and he's 20 years old and he's enormous, and he doesn't really move around like super fluidly. So I think he's a first baseman long term. At the same time, he's like, you don't care in the way that you don't care that Miguel Cabrera in his prime was a first baseman. Like, he's going to mash. So he's going to be like an MVP caliber bat if everything is right. So you don't really care that you have to like spend one of your first baseman slots getting that guy in the lineup.
Or even if he's in the corner outfield, I mean, is he, it's like, you know, when JD Martinez at his 4 home run game, nobody was asking about his range in right field or whatever.
Yeah, he could also probably with his speed and where it is right now with his arm, he can probably play right field for 3 or 4 years. So I'm talking about like long-term positional concerns. And surely no one cares about that at this point.
Right. And the White Sox have a small outfield and, you know, you can live with it if he's hitting that well anyway. So,
yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, if you assume Abreu just gets old or he leaves or he becomes like a diplomat and tours the nation like healing children, and you kind of don't have a lot of like middle of the order bats in the system, you know, I don't think you'd really sweat having Jimenez at first long term. And, you know, maybe after that, you're kind of talking about Jake Berger, who's, you know, didn't put up great numbers in low A, so he's pretty far away. Or Casey Gillespie, who's hardly a sure thing, or whatever Nicky DeMonico turns out being. Like, it's not like there's a wave of, like, first baseman or that you have, like, Canerico and Adam Dunn, like, rooted to the spot that you have to worry about making him room. Like, Matt Davidson's a name, but no. Matt Davidson also has OBP in the 260, so there's some improvement there that he has to take place before. He's someone you're planning around long-term as well, so it's not like he's creating a logjam at first base DH if he winds up there.
You're right. You do have the DH slot, so, like, even if, I don't know, let's say Eloy comes up in September or something of next year, like, I don't know, Jose Abreu maybe starts being the full-time DH instead, that sort of thing. Okay, so... those are the, and the flaws in Kopech are just, he's a pitcher, same as every pitcher.
I mean, typical pitch, like, he's a pitcher, his, you know, as recently as, like, 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, we thought that his command was too fringy, that he was probably going to need a couple more years before it became, you know, something that was major league ready, and, you know, maybe a year in AAA reveals that there's still more work to be done, and, you know, probably his first year in the majors, he'll probably walk an above average rate until that settles down. We might be too accustomed already to the idea that he can pound the zone with strikes more than he really can, because that was, you know, very much a shortcoming coming into the year. He's still only 21. So there's still stuff to overcome, but, you know, there's really no one in baseball who can sit 96 plus 100 pitches with life the way he can, or has something around a 60-70 slider at this point.
You mentioned
his stuff is just overwhelming. His frame is ideal. There's everything that you can't buy or develop in someone else, he has.
You mentioned during one of the earlier questions about possibly seeing him after the Super 2 date next year. Do you really think it could possibly be that soon? I was kind of under the impression that maybe it'd be like September 2018 would be the earliest we'd see him. But do you think it'd really be a matter of, oh, he's going to get promoted as soon as the service time games get played next year?
No, I wouldn't say it's as soon as that. I say that's just the soonest. Like, if he's literally just cut to AAA like a hot knife through butter, like for 8 weeks, and, you know, a bunch of guys go down with injuries, and James Shields joins Abreu on the diplomat mission of healing children, and it clears out a permanent slot that quickly, or, like, you know, God, I can't believe I entirely forgot about Tillon Covey as someone who's going to AFL to start more. but if they don't have the kind of issues of clearing out a permanent space for him, then, yeah, it could happen that soon if he's really, you know, that good.
Yeah, I mean, he already has... His outings in AAA were successful on paper. And I guess, I mean, that's the thing with a guy like Kopech is,
his stuff's that good, if he's getting it in the zone and locating it, like, there isn't really much left to leave him down for. It's not like a hitter where it's like, yeah, I still want to give him 400 more looks at minor league curveballs before I let him see major league ones. But, I mean, our Jared Seidler had actually, I think, mentioned, we've been talking, and he said that had nominated Kopech as a guy who might benefit from, you know, sitting more 96-97 instead of sitting like 97-99, which he's like capable of doing, just to, you know, get a better handle on things, not have to pitch max effort all the time. And I think that's kind of what, whether it was a conscious choice or not, I feel like, didn't he sort of dial it back a little bit around the time in Double A where he started to go way deeper into games and just stop walking people?
I don't really know. I don't have as precise velocity reports as that. I know he generally varies between 96 and 100, but he was still plenty capable of touching 100 down the stretch. I think he, like, there was some report of some late game, like his last trip in Birmingham, he hit like 99 on like his 99th pitch or 100th pitch or something like that. So he might have been dialing a bit back, but not something there. He like lowered his velocity band like permanently or anything like that I noticed.
Okay. So no, that is exciting though, to think that Kopech might be in the rotation as soon as next. I mean, you might also, like you said, if the rotation is as we imagined, and let's say, you know, Shields is muddling through and Rodon is healthy, that it may be, I mean, if the organization is still trying to figure out what they have with Fulmer, I feel like that would be the most likely, you know, block of Kopech, because I don't see why you're not going to like boot Rodon, Giolito, or Lopez from the rotation if they're performing. So
yeah, and you might, if you're have a veteran sign and flip candidate that you're pushing through with, and maybe you are keeping them in rotation through July as you try to market them or something like that. Or, you know, the fact Kopech could struggle. I mean, his first two starts in AAA were fine. They were good, and they're emblematic of the fact that he has good stuff. But, like, he definitely wasn't cruising through it the way he was in Birmingham. He definitely faced more difficulty. He definitely racked up higher pitch counts. I think he left both starts after five innings. I think he, you know, his walks kind of ticked up a little bit. It's not like he's AAA was not going to be any kind of adjustment or more difficulty on him. So I think he could be in a spot where he's still only kind of getting into his groove and starting to master it there in June. And I don't think it's just going to be like, you know, Chris Bryant in 2015, where it's absurd that he's even there, like, immediately from the first pitch.
Right. Cool. I think I feel pretty good. I think we covered Eloy Kopech. I mean, if we go at this rate, we're probably not going to touch half the list. There's sort of I like that you sort of had a layout structure in your list, and, you know, go subscribe and read it if you haven't already. I find it confusing if you've listened to this much of this podcast and you don't subscribe to James over at The Athletic. But
well, you don't, Nick.
Interesting for you to say that, Nick.
I do subscribe to The Athletic. I've had some technical difficulties, which are probably my fault. But
wait, I never resolved that thing where, like, they couldn't figure out where your email address was. Did I?
Well, I think you put the ball in my court and I didn't hit it back. So it's fine. I think I subscribed through the app, and I don't know. I can't just, like, email my thumbprint or whatever from my iPhone to The Athletic. So, I look at this next sort of group of guys, and, you know, Luis Robert, Alec Hansen, and you got Dylan Cease in this group. I mean, those three all arguably have ceilings that are kind of like right up there with, or at least in the same conversation, I would think, as Jimenez and Kopech, but they're not, they're a lot riskier, I would say. Is that a fair assessment of this group?
Sure.
Generous tendencies to say that they're at the Kopech level, but they do have premium velocity and an exciting breaking pitch.
each, I would say.
I really had to be pushed a lot to put him that high. I really didn't want to. I mean, he's not only a live arm in low A, which is like, not to invoke Tinstat, but like, really, there's not like a paucity of guys who throw hard and have a big breaking pitch and are still developing third pitch and command. Like, that fits a lot of descriptors. I haven't got to see him personally. He's not putting up big, like, incredible numbers that you've never seen anybody do before. So it's a lot of just taking the word of all the people who talk to Sahadev about him when he's in the Cub system about, like, this is an ace ceiling, this is ace stuff. And without really much track record of getting the results that you expect from someone who's supposed to dominate in the major leagues in 2-3 years. On top of the fact that he's had Tommy John surgery and got shut down this year for shoulder fatigue, like all the kind of like qualifiers that usually minimize, you know, a top pitching prospect are kind of there, but it's everyone just saying like the ceiling, the stuff. And I mean, part of the fact is that beyond Cease, there's really not like superstars anymore in the system. The system has a lot of depth.
Man, only five superstars? That sucks.
A lot of, like, interesting guys. But, yeah, it's not as strong as it was, 6 weeks ago. They graduated a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you graduate... You know,
Nicky Delmonico.
Nicky Baseball.
Yeah. The global number one, and then...
Everyone wants to do stakes, because that's, like, the obvious thing.
I don't like stakes.
I've heard worse... Twitter nicknames for White Sox players and stakes. I'll put it that way.
That's definitely true.
But yeah, I mean, it is really interesting how you like, you know, when you look at even just this next group, especially right after, I guess Bisabe and maybe Adolfo are the types of dudes who might wind up stars if everything aligns correctly. But there's definitely this clump between, you know, these top five guys, and then the back half of the top 10, where, you know, if you have Dane Dunning is a guy that I'm personally really into. I think he's awesome, but I think, you know, even from scouting
reports. Me too, to the point where I have to check myself about it.
Right, and it's like the scouting reports that I saw from earlier this year even were saying, you know, this guy is a number four. You could bump him to a number three if you're really, really into him playing up because of his pitchability. And he could, like, you know, I see what that scout's talking about. But then, you know, even if, like, I just personally find it hard to imagine that Cease is ever going to throw, like, 180 innings in a season in the majors.
Right.
There's still that, you know, 95th percentile outcome where Cease is, like, a Cy Young candidate, and I just don't see that with Dunning. So is that where that, I mean, we're talking about the fifth and sixth dudes in a system. I don't think you're throwing the gauntlet down here and saying like Cease is way better than Dunning or something like that. But the range of outcomes is just so wild for a guy like Cease.
Yeah. You're just giving the slight nudge to a guy with the bigger tools and the bigger ceiling, which is the way scouts like to go. And I am not as much confidence as I have in the things I've written. The kind of job for me is here not to be an evaluator myself, but more to be a reporter about what I'm being told. So scouts get drool about when they see somebody with, you know, what they think is an 8 fastball or a 7 curveball. And that's where they, you know, assign more value than this guy is definitely going to be a number 4 starter and the kind of certainty that it brings. And, you know, part of it is Dunning is, you know, kind of his origin is cool. Like, for the third piece of a trade, having somebody who's actually in a stick and rotation feels like found money. For a guy who was a reliever in college, being able to convert him successfully to a rotation feels like found money. To have a guy who's, you know, started in low A, who has as much certainty and like safety as he is, that feels like unique and cool. So there are all these things that make his profile really interesting. Besides the fact, like, you know, I think if you look at like a screen cap of Dane Dunning, you see like this really skinny face with these dorky glasses, and you kind of like, you kind of like, well, this kid looks like he's like 15. Like, yeah, and he's low in low A. Of course, he's really far away. Danny Dunning's huge. He's jacked. He's like 6'4", like thickly built. Like, he definitely looks like a starter. So like everything about him and like the way his origin and the way he looks and, you know, his attitude is extremely, to go entirely in Scottian cliche, he's a bulldog. The whole thing about beating Lucas or Seg for hitting a home run off him is probably a little too far, but
yeah, that's not chill. But yeah, you wrote about how he was just like crazy competitive, and I, you know, even for professional athlete, he stands out for that.
He tells you about how you did something bad, which is, you know, throwing it at a guy's head, and he's unapologetic about it. That's also bad. But he says it in a way where you kind of understand, like, I don't know, the way people gravitate towards, like, violent crime lords or something. Like, it's compelling coming out of his mouth. Like, yeah, that's awesome. Like, that's a crazy, awful, like, that's a bad, violent thing you did, but it kind of sounds kick-ass. And I wish you had nailed him. That would have been awesome. Like,
It's so funny, too, because, like you said, it's so incongruous. We're like, here's our safe number four starter. He's got to change up first. Like, that's his best pitch or whatever. And then it's like, yeah, he's like a maniac. but then, yeah, even this whole group of guys in different ways. I mean, Zach Collins, like, so much of that is, you know, which position he's going to wind up at and how much he'll hit. I still think of him as a high floor guy just because he's probably, you know, would be like an okay major league first baseman if they gave up on the catching project. Jake Berger, probably going to be an okay major league first baseman. Blake Rutherford's probably going to be an okay corner outfielder. Like, Spencer Adams is probably going to be like a solid back end starter. So like all these, I can see where the sorting happened, especially if you're going through scouts as well. Like, that all makes sense to me. Did I mischaracterize any of these guys in my shorthand there?
Yeah, I mean, like, the people who are down on Blake Rutherford at the time of the trade and, like, this isn't worthy of being the centerpiece of trading, like, big assets like Tommy Canley was at the time. Though Canley's, like, command jump that he had with the Sox has kind of gone away since the trade. Not that you should have valued him less at the time because of it. But the people who are down on Blake Rutherford is like, well, the people who love him think he's a 6-hit, 6-power, but I think he's a 5-hit, 5-power.
Oh, no.
If he's an athletic defender and he has average tools and a good approach, you know, out of corner outfield, that's probably fine. Like, yeah, he's not a star, but he could be, you know, a regular with that. He's not going to be... I compared him like young Melky Cabrera.
Is what I was going to say Melky. Melky was like the shape of production was something I was thinking of.
Melky is probably more like 6-hit, 4-power than 5-5, but it'd be that type of value. But you'd have him for 6 years and for cheap and probably better defense.
He wouldn't be your biggest like position player free agent other than Jose Abreu for the last like 15 years.
That's kind of extra context in there, more beyond the value of Rutherford. But yeah.
Well, I guess I'm skipping over Dunn as well with that, but it's right there.
Yeah.
The Melky contract.
So
for sure.
Were you gonna say something, Nick?
I'm sure I was, but go for it, Colin.
No, I was just gonna say, kind of dropping down on this list a little further. You kind of Nick alluded to this earlier, but there are kind of tiers of prospects here. With the top five, and then probably 6 through 9, and then you even note, James, a drop-off between 9, Blake Rutherford, and 10, Spencer Adams, and kind of the, you know, splitting of hairs between different guys here. Is there anyone among those kind of last 20 who is, like, a personal favorite of yours, or even someone who you could see kind of taking a leap within the next year or two to, like, top 5, top 10 in the org, and not even including like because of graduates?
So someone after Adams or starting at Adams?
Starting at Adams from the drop off that you mentioned. That or, I don't know. I mean, just someone that you like the possibility of them kind of progressing to becoming more than just a lesser prospect.
I mean, if so I irrationally like Micah just because I like him as a person. He's a very thoughtful dude. His talk through, like, the way he fixed his approach, or as he said, he didn't have an approach before now, is really convincing. But I kind of got talked into dropping him down further, even though, you know, someone who could be an athletic corner outfielder with a huge throwing arm and, you know, hopefully you hope for enough power to be like, I don't know, like a 120 WRC plus guy kind of on a regular basis. Yeah, like a star, but very solid for that position. But I got talked out of him being like, you know, he still doesn't have enough of an approach, still strikes out way too much, and doesn't have enough bat speed, is always going to, he needs like an elite approach to make his bat speed profile work, like something like Adam Dunn's level of like batting eye, and he doesn't have anything close to that. So I kind of got talked out of having him up there. But, you know, he'd be someone that, you know, the raw tools, the raw power, and he kind of has, would be exciting, would be someone who could be, you know, I don't know about top five, but I guess top 10 at some point. Despite the fact that I've been very active on dropping him in the list as kind of the make a point about relievers not having value, and the fact that, you know, he currently is under the knife for Tommy John surgery, or not currently, it's done, but you know, there's a really real scenario where Zach Birdie comes back, you know, his stuff comes back, and he's a closer for a 4 or 5 year period. And as much as we talk about relievers being, you know, not as valuable, if he becomes that, fits that role, like, obviously that's a huge part of the team. And, you know, maybe Ryan Burr becomes that as well at some point, you know, without having to navigate the whole injury part of it. And I think I had him down in 26 because, you know, he's a reliever who was in high A. So that's both pretty far away and not, you know, not top at value. Who else? I mean, if, you know, someone like, it's probably way too early to be down on Gavin Sheets. You know, if he becomes a big left-handed power bat, obviously that's something. Jordan Stevens is probably a really fun reliever or interesting back-end starter. So I don't think that quite leaps up to like top five at any point. I really have no idea what to make of Ian Clarkin since, he's in such a weird situation. Like, this one hand, like, he was pretty highly regarded in the Yankee system, relatively, but it's hard to see why, both because he's been in high A like 3 years in a row, but it's could be a fact that the injuries are constantly, you know, shortening seasons, the reason he hasn't been able to advance. And, but, you know, at the same time, a pitcher getting repeatedly hurt is not a selling point. It's a negative. So,
yeah. Don't worry about his lack of performance. He's just always hurt. Like, that's not reassuring at all.
Right. Amado Nunez is supposed to be really toolsy, and he's 19 and basically just hasn't gotten to play much. So, you know, he could be a star down the road. We really just haven't really seen him to base anything on. So, theoretically, he could be a guy who jumps way up down the road. Like, I don't move the ratings around for the sake of jokes, but it did amuse me to put Amado Nunez, who's all just tools and reputation of being a prospect, who we have no idea about his performance and I haven't really seen him play much at any kind of like meaningful level at all, and have him right next to Jake Peter, who is absolutely a utility man who's just hitting well in AAA, but otherwise doesn't have like any kind of like, you know, big reputation as being the top prospect, and having them basically like, yeah, they're basically the same value at this point.
That was a good pairing. Ditto the Birdie and Jason Rizzari.
We have no idea. Yeah. He's got a huge throwing arm. He plays shortstop. He's got pop. He the line that I remember is, there's loving to swing, and then there's what this guy does. It's the like, description of his play approach. So So it's hard to, like, really project that he's ever going to fix that to some major degree, but at the same time, the tools are there. But, you know,
yeah, the prospect to people I talked to on our end when that trade happened, I was like, you know, what should I think of this return that I got in this trade with the Rangers, was like the simultaneously damning but also exciting answer of he's way better than you'd expect for IFA money in a trade. But that's, like, you know, not saying a whole lot either.
I mean, yeah, because the White Sox dealt, like, Alex Katzaway for IFA money right before the Luis Robert deal. And I don't expect to see Alex Katz in the majors.
Well, he's with Baltimore, right?
Yeah.
So maybe.
Yeah.
Pitched in the WBC.
Luis Gonzalez would be a guy who could be top five. He's really talented.
That's what I was looking for. I was waiting for you to bring up Luis Gonzalez.
I mean, are we just all assuming, like, Bisabe is the first name next on the list? And I mean, isn't he, you know, he's a high ceiling type dude as well.
He's toolsy. I don't know if he's high ceiling.
Okay. I mean, oh, really? All right. I would think that, you know, if you could play good center field and hit for power, I mean, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
I mean,
he'll probably have swing and miss in his game. And, you know, you probably can't, like, even with advanced approach, like, or, you know, relatively advanced approach, like, you're probably hoping that he hits for a little bit of pop and has an average OBP and plays good center field defense and is fast. But I wouldn't call him, like, star potential or...
Okay. Would Gonzalez be... What sort of shape would his production look like if things go, I don't know, medium... Like, if I'm not talking, like, 90th percentile outcome, but, like, let's say if we got, like, a 60 to 80 percentile outcome on Luis Gonzalez, like, what would that look like?
Let's say an 80 is like him OBP 350 and, like, slugging a little bit over 400 and playing good center field defense and running around super fast.
Adam Eaton?
Yeah, I mean, guess
that's, kind of what you just,
probably lower,
that's what you just described. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, so like you were sort of indicating, I mean, that's a pretty nice find for a third-round pick, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely, everything I've heard is him as a first two-round talent. And with kind of meh reviews on Berger and, like, on Sheets, you know, I kind of, it's a way to kind of hint at that, but twisted it as a compliment to Gonzalez more than a knock on them.
Yeah, when you said that is potential to be the best player of the 2017 draft, I assume you mean of the White Sox draft.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
That. Not of the whole class. Although I suppose if he turns into Adam Eaton, then, you know, I guess it's not the craziest thing.
Lewis.
How much merit is there to the position that we should root the hardest for AJ Puckett, because if he turns out to be really good, that's the funniest because it's trolling the Royals?
I guess. Who are the other main trade partners? I guess, like, everyone likes to stick their finger in the eye of the Yankees, but yeah,
Texas, not that exciting.
No, I just think it'd be funny that, you know, you traded a rental of Melky Cabrera and then Kansas City immediately went absolutely in the toilet. And then, you know, they can't develop starting pitchers at all. Then you turn around and take one of their second round picks and turn him into a decent starting pitcher would be, I would like that narrative. I'd like that.
Yeah, they're definitely more trolly. I think if Taquan Forbes became a Hall of Famer, I think Texas would never get how bewildered they were by the fact.
Maybe that'll offset Fernando Tatis Jr. turning into a Hall of Famer.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, I know the Royals and AL Central foes are more your thing as far as trolling, but I think...
Don't act like you were one of us once, James. What are you acting all high and mighty, Mr.
It's
Professional?
My thing,
can't
too.
Make fun
and
of
I
AL
would rather
Central anymore.
Traded... Okay. I set that up poorly. I apologize.
James Fegan loves the Royals.
He does.
No, that place is hotter than hell. I thought I was going to die there. I don't know how Melky survived, given how many line drives he had to run down. That horrible 100-degree constantly series. I think it was July. But what you're going to read, like, more columns than you ever wanted to read about is how the Cubs traded away, like, a special guy. Or how I think there's a strong possibility. I mean, just from the fact that, you know, people appreciate monster home run hitters more than they appreciate, you know, mid-rotation starters, even if that's exactly what the Cubs need at this point. You're going to read so much about how giving Eloy to the White Sox is just like the big black mark on Theo's resume, I feel like.
Even worse than, like, giving all that money to Carl Crawford.
Yeah, because it's good.
No, I know. I know. I get it. It was
by decision, I feel because like he, I was did it. By the fact they gave away, like, the franchise-centered cornerstone bat of the White Sox the next 10 years in a trade. Like, that's going to be... It's already not something they're happy about. And it's, like, once he gets in the majors, once he has, like, a few big seasons, it's going to dominate, like, the narrative all the time. And I guess to the point where we're going to get very legitimately sick of it.
But, like, whether it's not that this has any actual, like, merit per se, but whether, like, how Jose Quintana pitches in the playoffs, I feel like is going to help dictate how severe that is. Because, like, let's say Quintana, like, carries their staff and they win another World Series. Like, people defend the Aroldis Chapman trade because they won the World Series. And Chapman, like...
on that basis.
And, like, if Quintana actually pitches well in the playoffs and wins the World Series, I mean, that's, like, a much more defensible thing, right? I mean, like, A, you know, Quintana is, like, a much better human being. But B, like, you know, you're getting three, four years of a starting pitcher as opposed to 20 innings of a reliever who wound up blowing the save in Game 7 of the World Series. So I don't know. I mean, you're right. That's, like, a fair warning, especially anyone who consumes Chicago-heavy media, which, you know, sounds like it should describe White Sox fans. That is certainly an area of concern. I also wonder, though, it's like, you know, even these elite corner bats like J.D. Martinez and Edwin Encarnacion have been, like, so devalued on the market of late. Like, is this again, like, an inconsistency in how people think of things? Like, if I'm not saying Eloy's not super valuable if he turns into one of those bats. It doesn't feel like that's... It feels like the marketplace values a Quintana more than a bat like that.
I don't know it might not be entirely fair to say, like, there's a difference between developing your own bat and getting him for, like, the duration of his early and mid-20s as opposed to paying for that bat in free agency, which I think is more where the devaluation is coming.
And I guess where that places these guys on the aging curve.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'm just thinking out loud here. Always good to do that on a podcast with a guest.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, this trade is going to go better down than it would, you know, 25 years ago when, you know, people think, you know, like, Quintana's a mediocre guy who has a 500 record. As opposed to a guy who's hitting 35 home runs and knocking in 100. Obviously, there's more greater context to the understanding, and it'll probably be less insufferable than it otherwise would be. But I just think it's probably going to be the big attention grabber rather than squeezing a number 5 starter out of AJ Puckett.
True. I just think one is much more, stealing any potential starting pitchers from the Royals has, I think, a bigger impact on the White Sox success than whatever happens with the Cubs. But that's an argument I am never going to persuade people of.
It's probably going to be like a small source of satisfaction that you tweet about every now and then after a good start, especially every time. Had a lot of fun every time John Danks pulled shoulder surgery, just inexplicably rolled the Royals in their prime for like 8 innings. So I think it'll be a kind of small piece of satisfaction like that every time, like, Puckett, like, mucks through 6 innings successfully for a quality start. through a Royals in the depth of their like dark rebuilding phase that they'll probably be in, and they're already always going to be in for, you know, 3-4 years after this. And Puckett wasn't going to, you know, save them from that.
Probably not. I think we are approaching the amount of asking about your article to the point where we're just sort of backdooring your paywall, which I don't want to do. Before we wrap, I do want to ask, because we have been kind of, especially over the last month or so, closing episodes, what is going to happen with the wild card spots?
The Twins are going to win the whole fucking thing, baby. World Series.
I know our BP's editor-in-chief will be thrilled with that.
Hey, you know, the AL one's not the only one up for grabs anymore.
World Series over the Brewers.
Like, the Brewers are closing in on the... every couple episodes, Nick, we would talk about the AL race. We wouldn't talk about the NL race, but the Brewers might catch the Rockies.
Yeah, although they had... Apparently last night was about as devastating a loss as the Brewers fan base on Twitter is usually like, I would largely describe it as like a benign group. And I mean that in like the sense of they're like, they seem like a cheerful, mellow group of people. And they were really unhappy after last night's loss.
Yeah.
I think Nebel like chucked a ball into a swinging bunt into right field. And then, they gave up a walk off to like Adam Frazier or something like that. I mean, and Neville's been quietly like crazy good this year. So, but yeah, they're a game back on the Rockies.
Yeah.
James, who's which one of them's getting that gonna play the Diamondbacks?
One quick aside, nothing will like convince you of the difference in quality of like AAA baseball, like seeing Adam Frazier be freaking God in a game during a rehab assignment, like he was in Indianapolis. It's like wreaking mortal terror on Tyler Danish and the rest of the Knights pitching staff. And it's freaking Adam Frazier.
He's like a quad A bat, I guess.
Yeah. But there, I think there's no limits to the depth of the Rockies tank, and they will fall all the way out. And the Brew Crew, and the friend that we have who works there that we can't talk about will have their moment in the sun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really bummed that they can't throw Jimmy Nelson in that wild card game or have his services down the stretch. But
if the Brew Crew was the Brewers fans were devastated by the game last night, I think your staff ace having a career altering injury from sliding in the first should probably be more aggravating. Like, I get aggravated, and I'm not even like in the fan perspective of like how many games Larry Garcia has lost from his breakout season from sliding in the first. So I can only imagine Jimmy Nelson going down for that.
I have to imagine that part of their negative emotions at last night's loss were sort of tied together with Nelson's like, but you know how every surgery, almost every surgery you ever hear of, like the initial report is like the surgery was a success, by which I think the definition for the surgeon would be like, we found what we expected and we corrected it. And as far as we know, nothing went wrong. But like, it's always this really bland piece, right? It's like so-and-so underwent surgery and it was a success. The headline for Nelson's surgery was like, it was way worse than we thought. We opened his shoulder and it was like even worse. So that's horrible.
You opened his shoulder with an eye note.
Okay, so as the world's biggest Twins and Royals fan, we really appreciate you coming out and talking so much about the White Sox today, James. Thank you so much.
Twins Nation, baby. Kyle Gibson, playoff start, World Series MVP. Adalberto Mejia will be, you know, lock down the final out by pitching a complete game shutout like Josh Beckett.
All right, rank the following outfielders for what you think their careers are going to wind up being. Byron Buxton, Max Kepler, Eddie Rosario, Willie Mays.
Let's see. I'm going to go Kepler 1. Buxton 2, Rosario 3, Prince, who will resurrect in the middle of Game 5 and burst forward from the outfield dirt and snap a screaming liner out of the air while, like, drumming like 4, Willie Mays 5.